You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko joul toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te wai mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to the Wai Parahina Monday. I'm your host Joel and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm joined in the studio by producer Alex. Coming up on the show for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, I spoke to MP Simon Court about this weekend's Palestine rally, the March for Humanity, and Regulations Minister David Seymour not ruling out changes for labelling on alcohol, nicotine and tobacco products. I spoke to Emma Anderson, a PhD candidate in bioethics in the Bioethics Centre at the University of Otago, about a recent study she was the lead author in, showing New Zealand media's coverage of the COVID-19 pandemic having nationalistic and us versus them elements in its reporting. And Thursday Y host Caden, Thursday producer Sanat, and Tuesday Y host Sarah interviewed participants at Saturday's March for Humanity, as well as Aotearoa for Palestine organizer Nadine Mortaja. Alex, what do you have for us today?
I spoke with the University of Otago's Robert Patman about recent Russian drone incursions in Poland, what they mean for NATO, and the Russia-Ukraine conflict. I also spoke to the University of Otago's Michael Holland about artists leaving Spotify and the issues with the platform.
Here are Hofokaro. We would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tukupatuhi mai, text in on 5395, or Waiamairane, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Kaua e ware ware, e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrerano. Hei pakihiri rokiroki mā runga, i te pai, tukutuku o irirangi pōho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
On Saturday, roughly 20,000 marched in the pro-Palestine rally, the March for Humanity, with protesters walking from Altea Square to Victoria Park in Auckland's CBD. For our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court, we discuss this rally and what protesters are calling on the government for regarding their response to Israel's war on Gaza, as the death toll in Gaza reaches over 64,000, according to Gaza's Ministry of Health. As well as this, Regulations Minister and ACT Party leader David Seymour has not ruled out changes to the labelling of alcohol, nicotine and tobacco products. However, firstly, we discuss the March for Humanity rally.
We've seen a plethora of similar rallies occur across the nation during Israel's war on Gaza. What does this say to how the government is responding to the situation?
Well, I first want to acknowledge the terrible scenes that we've all seen in Gaza, and that civilians caught in a crossfire is always awful in war. This is a war that Hamas started on the 7th of October, nearly 2 years ago in 2023, attacking sleeping families in their rural communities, the Nova Festival massacre. They took hundreds of hostages, including bodies of young women that abused, back to Gaza, while civilians came out in the street in Gaza cheering for Hamas, a scene that was absolutely shocking to me, and repeated in many Western countries as well at the same time. So I guess the test for those who attended the protest in support of River to the Sea and Globalise the Intifada and Palestine Will Be Free and sanctions on Israel, and that includes Labour and Green politicians who attended, is what do they actually think this means and what do they want? Because Gaza was free and under Hamas exclusive control for nearly 20 years before the 7th of October, and they turned it into a terrorist hellhole where anyone who spoke up was murdered in most horrible ways, including people who are accused of being gay. So, you know, that's my response to the protests, and I think, you know, most conscious empathetic Kiwis would feel the same way.
Green Party co-leader Marama Davidson, who was at the rally, said the pro-Palestinian protesters showed leadership where the government has not. Is this true? How has the government shown leadership regarding their response to Israel's war in Gaza?
Well, what the government has done is sent tens of millions of dollars of aid to be distributed to civilians in Gaza, and you know, watching very carefully to make sure that doesn't fall into the hands of Hamas. What we've also done is made it very clear to the Israeli government that some of their members who are making divisive and inflammatory statements about Palestinian lands, places where Palestinians live, are unacceptable, and those individuals have been sanctioned by the government. But I just want to reflect on the protest. And for those people going back to work this morning or going to class and feeling proud about the weekend flag waving, I need to remind you that most New Zealanders, including your fellow students and your workmates, don't share some of the worldviews that have been adopted by people in the protest. Because in the end, this war, no matter how much we might be concerned about civilian suffering, is going to end like all wars do, when the combatants are so exhausted they can't go on, or one side's victorious over their enemy. And the only question we should really be asking is, will Hamas give up the hostages and lay down their weapons first to spare civilians before they lose the war?
Protesters called on the government to sanction Israel, called for an unconditional ceasefire, an urgent end to Israel's blockade, and the reinstatement of the United Nations Relief and Works Agency to allow aid into the besieged Gaza Strip. Are any of these demands the government would want to work towards?
Well, calls for sanctions on Israel don't really stand up to any rational analysis of the conflict, because it is a complex and awful situation. But at the moment, you know, Hamas leaders in Gaza are trying to sneak out. At least four senior Hamas officials have left Gaza via Israel for third-party countries in the past few weeks. They're giving up the locations of hostages' bodies. No doubt they're telling the Israelis where to find Hamas leadership. But outside Gaza, Hamas leadership is telling Palestinians to stay in harm's way. It's just a truly awful situation. But for New Zealand to jump on the sanctions bandwagon that these protesters and even some, you know, Green and Labour politicians are calling for would undermine the long-term safety, the long-term security of similar small democracies like Ukraine, like Taiwan, and of course, in the end, the security of our own nation, New Zealand. Because democracies like ours have no choice. We can't accept what Hamas did on October 7th without making sure it never happens to them again.
On to our next topic. Regulations Minister and ACT Party leader David Seymour has not ruled out potential label changes on alcohol, tobacco and nicotine products. Seymour says the removal of labels altogether was not on the cards, but has not ruled out the nature of these labels, such as using the colour red to warn of the dangers of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, or FASD. Why would the Regulations Minister not rule out these changes? Why is the colour of warning labels on the cards?
Well, because in the food and alcohol beverage industry and others, there are 30 different codes, standards and regulations that dictate what information must be shown on a label and how it must be shown. A lot of these products are manufactured for export markets as well, but they have to comply with New Zealand conditions and then have an oversticker put on them or a separate label. So it's really about just making it easier for New Zealand manufacturers and suppliers to meet their obligations around making sure people understand what products are safe and what the risks are. But also just make it much easier to comply. And I just want to make it clear, the reason that the reason that we're not ruling out any changes to alcohol or tobacco labelling is because no decisions have been taken. So, look, it's all in the mix. But I think you made a point about fecal alcohol syndrome. It's an awful, awful condition imposed by parents when they drink while pregnant. It does massive harm to unborn children, And there must be a far more effective way to address that risk than simply the colour or the words on a label, because if fetal alcohol syndrome is continuing to be a problem, then clearly the labels we have now, no matter how well-intentioned, just aren't working.
We'll touch on that point in a sec, but firstly, Alcohol Health Watch Executive Director Andrew Galloway says the colour of the label was implemented by Food Standards Australia and New Zealand following research into what is effective when it comes to labelling. He adds that Seymour is putting profit over public health. Is this true? Is the minister going against the evidence here?
Well, look, if a craft brewery can provide a warning that is more eye-catching and gets the message across in a better way, why wouldn't we allow that? And we don't need to have rules that add costs for no benefits. And the fact that some health bureaucrats in Australia and New Zealand probably spent millions of dollars having endless committee meetings to work out what colour things should be is clearly not working. So I think we need to trust people who are experts in making sure that the customers know what the products do and how they should be used and what the risks are, because ultimately, as the manufacturers, they are responsible.
If the party then doesn't believe that the colour of the label is effective in warning people of the harms of FASD, for example, what would be a better approach to emphasise the dangers of consuming alcohol, nicotine and tobacco products?
Well, as I pointed out, I can't confirm what changes might be made because there's a sector review into product labelling, and yeah, that means that Alcohol Health Watch or whichever groups think they have some good suggestions can contribute to the review. No decisions have yet been taken, but what we do know is that people respond to different forms of communication, and you know, a single colour or a colour chart dreamed up by health bureaucrats isn't necessarily going to be the only way to reach people.
That was the ACT Party's Simon Court on this past weekend's March for Humanity pro-Palestine rally, and David Seymour not ruling out changes to the labelling on alcohol, tobacco and nicotine products.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
Well, first of all, I love it. Clearly you've given up on trying to have any sort of neutrality in this interview.
The Wire. On Saturday, tens of thousands of people joined the March for Humanity in Tāmaki Makaurau. The protesters were calling on the government to sanction Israel over its actions in Gaza. The protest was initially intended to be over the harbour bridge, but it was moved due to forecasted high winds. Instead, the march began in Altea Square and ended in Victoria Park. Producer Sanat and I were at the protest and spoke to rangatahi, politicians and community members about why they were there.
Hi, I'm Shanti. I go to college and I'm here because I support Palestine.
Do you have a message for the government today?
We need to stand together and we need to let our voices be heard.
Kia ora, my name is Malak. I am 15 years old. I'm Palestinian from West Bank, Hebron, and I've lived in Aotearoa for almost my whole life here and there, and I come today from Dunedin.
And what brings you to the march today?
What brings me to the march today is my motivation to stand up for my people. I know that there are so many people who want to be here today and here representing them, and as well as bringing hope to my family and friends and people in Palestine.
Do you have a message for the government?
My message to the government is to sanction Israel now and to take action towards sending aid to the people of Gaza and to help them. Because us as New Zealand, we are known to be a country that is constantly helping other countries around the world, and to be complicit in genocide is to be complicit against humanity.
My name is Dr. Emi Rakete, and I'm here because I've been watching children get turned inside out for the last 2 years on my phone while the government has to buy, you know, on one hand, lambasting the left-wing critics for wanting to do virtue signalling, as Winston Peters loves to say, and on the other hand, taking no substantive action against Israel to stop it from committing its crimes. No action to stop Raycon from selling components used in American bombs that have been dropped on Gaza. no sanctions, no action against Zionist diplomats in the country. And so I'm here with what looks like about 20,000 people to say that we need to see some real action from the government on the genocide.
And what do you think today's, or what message do you think today's march is sending to the government?
I mean, it shows that the government's wait and see, gently, gently approach is totally inadequate to the moment. There are thousands of people here, many of whom are not, unlike me, hardened, hardline Marxists. There are lots of people in suits, lots of people here with babies. There is a total cross-section of New Zealand society here saying that the government must do something differently. So the idea that the government can continue to coddle Israel, continue to coddle the United States, continue to bind us into military alliances with these countries, it's dead in the water. We need sanctions, we need expulsion of diplomats, we need real effort to bring the genocide to a conclusion, and these people are going to see it done.
Kia ora, my name is Ricardo and I'm a Green Party Member of Parliament.
And what brings you to the march today?
This is a march for humanity. I think people are coming here to protest the ongoing genocide that Israel is committing in Gaza, but actually people are standing up for our basic humanity and human rights. So it's encouraging to see a huge turnout today for everyday people to be demanding on our government to sanction Israel.
Do you have a message for the government today?
It's time for MPs to grow a spine and sanction Israel and to take meaningful action to stop this ongoing genocide. New Zealand has a role to play in the international stage. And so whether it's sanctions, statehood recognition, or actually calling it what it is, a genocide, our Prime Minister needs to do more.
Shannon Halbert, Labour List MP based in Northcote.
And so what brings you to the march today?
I've been attending rallies for Gaza over the past 12 months. It's an important kaupapa to me that really unites a core part of our community on an issue that's important to many New Zealanders, and that is that we want the government to take a stand against the unfolding genocide in Gaza. It's not good enough, and we want the government to take more action.
What sort of message do you think this crowd is sending to the government today?
It's all about people power. We believe in mana motuhake, and we want that for every Indigenous group across the world. And so a small part of what we can do as Kiwis is stand here in solidarity and kotahitanga today and show them our support, but most of all, put pressure on our government, on the Prime Minister Luxon, to actually do something, to show some leadership with some urgency, because we're all proud of the leadership that New Zealand has taken in the past on such issues, yet this government takes no action.
Kia ora, my name is Justine Sachs. I'm the co-founder of Dayenu, New Zealand Jews Against Occupation.
Can you talk about what brings you to the march today?
I'm here today to demand that the New Zealand government sanction Israel for committing crimes against humanity and the unfolding genocide we're witnessing in Gaza.
Do you think that today's march sends a strong message to the government?
I do, and I think the government needs to listen. We are witnessing a genocide. New Zealand needs to step up, sanction Israel, just like we sanctioned Russia for its illegal invasion of Ukraine. It's late, actually. We need to sanction Israel now. There needs to be consequences for its violations of international law, for its wanton murder of civilians, women, children, and men.
I know you've been to marches like this before. How does today's compare to other ones?
I think it shows that this isn't not going to go away. Look at the number of people here today. This is the conscience of Aotearoa showing up to say that we will not condone and be complicit in genocide. And I do not think this issue, we are not going to go away. Palestine will not go away. We will continue to show up. And I think that is evident here today. And we will march the bridge. I believe that.
My name is Hayam and I'm a uni student.
So what brings you here to the march today?
What brings me here is that we've seen 2 years of ongoing bombardment and genocide and our government doing absolutely nothing substantial to even try to intervene or stop that or even stand in solidarity. So.
And what sort of message do you want to send to the government today?
I want to send a message to the government that their citizens are very upset with their actions and more so their lack of action, and that we're here to show them that.
Hey, I'm Kukulin Howard. I am a University of Auckland student, Waipapa Tomatoro. I'm a geography student, and I think this is an important day to be here, and it's an important place to be at in terms of global politics, in terms of our position in global politics. We in Aotearoa, we have our own Tino Ranga Tiratonga, and we need to determine our own future and our own destiny with these actions that we take. And I think today is a real opportunity for you to come out and engage in some real geopolitical action that will have an impact globally.
Following the largest pro-Palestine march in New Zealand since October 2023, Aotearoa for Palestine spokesperson Nadine Mortaja spoke with Tuesday Wire host Sierra about the protest and the movement's demands for the New Zealand government.
How are you feeling about the number of people who rallied in support for Palestine in Auckland City on Saturday?
Oh, I'm feeling absolutely incredible. I mean, just seeing the amount of people show up showed me that the people here in Aotearoa care about the Palestinian people, and it showed me that we do want to sanction Israel for its war crimes. We do want the New Zealand government to do something, because Israel is a rogue state, and someone needs to hold them accountable. And I think just seeing the amount of endorsements that have rallied against, you know, with us, and there's been over 150 organizations that have supported this march. So that also shows me that the people in Aotearoa want demands, they want sanctions, and we do want something from the New Zealand government.
This was, I believe, the 100th week of protesting now since the first demonstrations nearly 2 years ago. Why has it been so important to hold these rallies every week?
We still want the people here in Aotearoa to know that there is a live stream genocide happening in Gaza. Since August as well, there's been a man-made famine happening. Not a single food truck has been allowed into Gaza because the Israeli occupation has denied it entry. So as a result of that, 500,000 people are facing catastrophic hunger. There are children and people that have actually starved to death as well. We are in 2025. How is this happening? How are we okay with watching this happen? So I think we still want people to realize that this is still happening. We can't go on about business as usual when there are people that are starving to death, when there are people that have, you know, lost their homes, that have lost their lives. They have bombed schools, hospitals, people's homes. So we do want people to realize that this is still happening and we can't go on about business as normal. So that's why it's still important for us to hold these demonstrations and to let people aware that there is a live stream genocide happening and we need to do something about it. And that is why right now the demand is to sanction Israel.
Has there been any kind of response from the New Zealand government in relation to this march or what you're calling for?
Well, we do. I mean, we'll give credit where credit's due. I mean, the New Zealand government has put travel bans on Smotrich and Ben-Gavir, but that isn't enough. We still need them to hold Israel accountable, and that, you know, that is to sanction them. That is to let them let aid into Gaza. So we do want the New Zealand government to do something. We are a small country, but we are also a mighty country. And we do want to look back at our history in 10 years' time. We do want to tell our kids we did something. Aotearoa did something for the people in Gaza. So we do want the New Zealand government to stand on the right side of history, and we need them to sanction Israel.
We've been seeing protests across the globe. Hundreds of thousands of people have showed up in Australia, the UK, and throughout Europe. Are you worried that political leaders seem to have lost their sense of urgency or obligation on this issue?
100%. The people have spoken, and it's time for our governments all around the world to listen to us, whether they're the governments in the UK, Australia, the governments here in New Zealand. We need someone to hold Israel accountable for its war crimes. It is a rogue state. It's a terrorist state. They have bombed schools, hospitals. They've bombed people's lives. People in Gaza used to live. It's a small city, but people in Gaza had weddings. They had lives. Children went to school. Why are we okay with this happening to them? Is it because they're Arab? Is it because they're Muslim? What is the reason this is happening to them? Because if this was happening in a Western country, nobody would stay still. Everyone would lose their minds. So why is this happening to the people in Palestine? Why aren't our governments holding Israel accountable for its war crimes? And that's why New Zealand needs to sanction Israel for its war crimes. It's a rogue state. We need to hold them accountable.
As a leader within this movement, how do you remain hopeful and staunch in your activism? And moreover, how would you recommend that others, especially in New Zealand, where this conflict is quite distant, to avoid becoming desensitized to the violence inflicted against Palestinians?
I think what keeps me going is the people in Gaza. I mean, when we march and when I chant for them. When we say anarajar, which means I'm returning, in English, translated to I'm returning in English, that means I am returning to Palestine. And we do believe that because us Palestinians, we do believe in the right of returning to our homeland. This is our rightful homeland. I am from Gaza. I've only been to Gaza once before in my whole life. That's my home. How is that fair? How do we justify that when people all around the world get to live in their homelands? Why is it that the Palestinians aren't allowed to do that? And that's why we've been fighting for this ever since we're born. We've been fighting for this. So that's why we need to do something, and something big. And that is why we need to sanction Israel for its war crimes. I mean, we are very privileged. We can put our phones down when we feel like it's too much, whereas the people in Gaza can't do that. They can't just sit and be like, okay, I'm done with the bombing. No, they can't do that. Whereas we have the privilege to put our phones down and to say, oh, I can't watch a live stream genocide through my phone. I need to take a break. The people in Gaza don't have a break. They haven't had a break since October the 7th. They haven't actually had a break since 1948. And that's why we need to do something, and something big. And that is to hold Israel accountable and to sanction them for its war crimes. I mean, Aotearoa, there's been a lot of fundraisers, there's been a lot of events, there's been a lot of gigs that have been hosted, and, you know, lots of people have donated to the people in Palestine. So I do applaud everyone that has done something in the movement. But what keeps me going personally is my people in Gaza. Their resilience keeps me going. Their faith keeps me going. I mean, you see like these videos of kids and their parents have passed away, but then they still say Alhamdulillah, which means thank God, you know, that we are still alive, that we are still fighting. So their resilience keeps me going.
How can people in Aotearoa continue to show their support for this movement, for this cause, beyond just this protest over the weekend?
Yeah, I think, I mean, showing up to protest is a great way. It's also a great way to like meet people, like-minded people, form a community, but also boycotting Israeli products. The main ones right now that we are boycotting is SodaStream, Coca-Cola, Obala Hummus. That is an individual goal that everyone can do, and it is achievable. So boycotting products that are manufactured in the Israeli occupation, but also writing to your local MPs. That's also another great tool. Meet up with your local MP, write to them. If it's too much to meet up with them, bring a buddy with you, go together and meet your MP and tell them that we need demands to sanction Israel for its war crimes. And also one more thing I would like to add is search up the Nakba. The Nakba is in 1948, and that is when 750,000 Palestinians were exiled out of Palestine, and they had to go to neighboring countries such as Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and that's when this whole conflict actually started. So there's a lot of history that people need to learn, but search up the Nakba, 1948.
That was Tuesday Wire host Sarah, producer Sanat, and me covering Saturday's protest for Palestine in Tāmaki Makaurau.
I know you must have another question, so I'll shut up.
The Wire.
We'll be right back. Text 5395 with any of your thoughts on these pieces.
Splore is back for the summer. So if you want to win a pass to a party like no other, with an insane lineup by a pristine beach, with a bunch of friends you haven't met yet, then grab that B card and stay tuned to 95BFM Drive all week for your chance to win.
Splore 2026, Beachside, Tāpapakanga Regional Park, February 20th to 22nd. Get your tickets at splore.net.
Tui just dropped a remix of their classic banger via Eco Store. Let's give it a spin.
Oh, mean. That's got my vote.
Yeah, vote Tui for Bird of the Year. They're the OG voice for nature with some sick vocals, pollinating superpowers, and a rock star attitude. Vote Tui, vote for nature at birdoftheyear.co.nz. Brought to you by EcoStore.
Traces, the collaborative album from Rian Sheehan and Ali Lieberman, is out now. Experience the ethereal cinematic world of Traces, an intimate and immersive soundscape that blends electronic, ambient, and post-rock. Traces by Rian Sheehan and Ali Lieberman, out now. Available digitally and on limited edition vinyl and CD at all good music stores.
The cat's out of the bag.
I look forward to seeing a sausage with a sword tonight.
The can of worms is open.
I reckon a cat with a sword would be pretty diabolical.
Pandora's box has been irreversibly meddled with.
They've already got heaps of little swords in their hands.
Introducing your brand new 95BFM breakfast show hosts, Millie and Rosetta.
I'm a fan.
You are a fan. I love that.
The 95BFM breakfast show. Tune in every weekday morning from 7 till 10 a.m. Only on 95BFM.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Balls. Thank you.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
A study from the University of Otago looking into how New Zealand news coverage depicted the country's responses to the COVID-19 pandemic has shown elements of nationalism and creating a sense of competition. I spoke to Emma Anderson, a PhD candidate in the Bioethics Centre at the University of Otago, about the study and the harmful consequences of this framing.
What was the inspiration for the study and the results of the study? Were they what you were expecting?
Yeah, so during the pandemic, there was this tension between focusing on what the country was doing, you know, a national country, and dealing with the crisis that was affecting the whole world, you know, pandemic, it's a global problem. And so nationalism is this idea that it's very inward focused, and it was a recognised issue during the COVID-19 pandemic. There were phrases like, this is a pandemic of nationalism, corona nationalism was a term that was thrown around. And so we wanted to see whether or not there was evidence for nationalism in New Zealand's public conversation, because an inward focus for a global pandemic where there requires global cooperation may not be ideal. So that's why we did what we did. We looked into the news media, because the news media can both shape and reflect public attitudes. And so we analysed 1,300 randomly selected news articles from 19 New Zealand newspapers to see if there was any evidence of this nationalism. And yeah, so what we found essentially was that there was strong nationalist reporting in these papers, in these articles, and there were four main themes that we picked up. So these were domestication, unification, securitization, and separation. And I'm happy to talk to those a little bit more if you'd like me to.
Yeah, that's actually my next question, is discussing how those four main themes you mentioned and how they sort of relate to Aotearoa's nationalistic approach to our coverage of the pandemic.
Yeah, it's a good question. So the first theme was domestication, and that's really a focus on home. And this was the most common theme. So this was found in nearly 3/4 of all the articles. And the news stories, they quite overwhelmingly concentrated on New Zealand's situation, such as local economy, daily case numbers, which isn't necessarily surprising because local news does report on local events. But this was a global pandemic, and there was very little coverage of how the pandemic was affecting other specific countries or the world as a whole. So that was the first theme. The second theme was unification, which is this idea of kind of Team New Zealand. And more than half of the articles included this theme. And it aims to create a sense of national unity using words like we and us to make it feel like everyone was in it together. And so the third theme was securitization, and this was around defending the borders. And so there's about 1 in 5 articles use this idea of securitization, talking about the pandemic as if it was a war, and the virus was treated as an enemy that New Zealand had to defend itself against. And there was this heavy focus on border controls, use of military-style language, so for example, you know, bunkering down and fighting to save New Zealanders' lives. And then that fourth theme was separation, and this one actually became more common over time, and it involved creating a divide between often New Zealanders and others. And this created this in-group, so often being New Zealanders, and an out-group, which was non-New Zealanders, which kind of really fed into that competitive narrative of it's us versus them, the rest of the world. And this pandemic is a competition that we need to win.
If we're looking back at this coverage, have we seen these negative consequences, the ones you've just mentioned, sort of continue into 2025 in any capacity?
I mean, it's difficult to know because we only looked into 2022, so we haven't really looked beyond that. But if you think of this idea of nationalism, COVID-19 brought the undercurrent of nationalism to the surface, I think, across the world, and that's why people were so concerned about this idea of nationalism, because even though it has this inward focus, which has this, on the one hand, can help create this sense of unity that you need for a public health crisis, it's that when you create an us, you create that them, and so it can feed into that them mentality where people are seen as less than, and other countries are seen as less than what's happening more locally.
And if we're speaking more to other countries, what are some of the differences between how New Zealand covered the pandemic compared to what other international news organisations, how they would have reported on the pandemic in their own countries?
Yeah, that's a good question. And as we only really looked into New Zealand's media, can't really make a direct evidence-based comparison. But what I can say is that our findings do seem to align with other broader international research. There have been other studies in countries such as Finland, and that same kind of competitive narrative, and also that theme of securitisation, so treating the health crisis like a war, wasn't unique to New Zealanders, and other researchers have found similar war metaphors being used all over the world. And so while the kind of team of 5 million was a uniquely New Zealand phrase, this general strategy of using nationalist language to build unity wasn't necessarily uncommon. And again, that's what led to a lot of scholars and commentators saying that there was this pandemic of nationalism that occurred at the same time. So while evaluations of the pandemic can often show, you know, focus on policy and what the policies were, evaluations have also showed this common theme of nationalism as a major problem to cooperation during the pandemic.
Now, we've discussed quite a few negatives, but is there any positives to this framing at all regarding how New Zealand responded to the COVID pandemic?
Yeah, it's another great question. So again, it's like, on the one hand, this inward approach, it can help to foster that sense of national unity, to help people encourage people to follow the public health rules, contributing to New Zealand's success in keeping illnesses and deaths low, which, you know, is a good thing, keeping illness and death low. It's, again, is that risk, though, every time you have that we and us, you're also creating the them, and so it's very difficult to sometimes separate that, and it has to be a very intentional choice, very intentional wording around how you can create a we without villainizing or making a competition with others.
Have politics played a role in the framing of the country's response to the pandemic? Did any political elements come up in your research?
Yeah, so again, we didn't really look at party politics specifically, but a lot of, as the media reports on both public perceptions and also reports what government, those things naturally come through. And, you know, we analysed the language that was reported in the media, and that does reflect a wider tension at a community and government level in New Zealand. So, for example, at a community level, research suggests that New Zealanders likely to see themselves generous and willing to contribute to global equity, but also at the same time, research shows this gap between values and actual behaviour. So, for example, another study done at the University of Otago found that when given a choice, over 70% of New Zealanders opt to donate to a domestic charity over a comparable global one. And that kind of New Zealand focus, that pattern, is also seen at the governmental level. So the policies that were enacted during the pandemic prioritised that national success over the global equity, and many wealthy countries did that. It wasn't just New Zealand. So New Zealand purchased more vaccines than what were needed and fell short of the pledged contributions to the global COVAX facility. And so we kind of see this tension between values of what New Zealand says to value and the actual contributions and that rhetoric versus reality, if you like.
To mitigate the nationalist elements of this coverage and the sort of us versus them mentality heading forward, especially if we were to see a similar outbreak in the future, what would you like to see?
It it's about finding that balance. So if we think of that lifeboat analogy, the goal is to get everyone to see that we need to work together to fix this main leak and not just bail water out from our own corner. And so for a next public health crisis, which is likely, the narrative can be framed around concepts of shared humanity and mutual interest in terms of solving a global problem, recognising, you know, it's not just about protecting New Zealanders' lives, but about protecting everybody's lives. You know, New Zealanders are no more or no less important than the rest of the world. And so helping those outside of borders, it's also a form of self-interest because no one's safe as everyone is safe as if, until everyone is safe, as I've often heard. And so, I mean, in terms of recommendations for political public health leaders, it would mean avoiding relying solely on national pride to build unity, instead appealing to global solidarity, emphasising that helping those in greatest need wherever they are is a priority. For public health communicators and the media, that means consciously working to build solidarity without using exclusionary language, including reporting about what's happening globally, not just about reporting what's happening locally. And again, this concept of shared humanity. And I think for the general public, it just means about reflecting what it is that we think and expanding our thinking to include concern for those who are distant, the distant stranger, and making an intentional effort to see all people as people, not just New Zealanders.
That was the University of Otago's Emma Anderson on a study she led into the framing of New Zealand news media's coverage of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire. Last week, Poland confirmed that Russian drones had entered and caused damage in Polish airspace. This incursion has been met with strong opposition, with Poland and NATO allies threatening retaliation. I spoke with the University of Otago's Robert Patman about the drones, other similar occurrences, and what the geopolitical implications of these incursions are in regards to Russia, the US and Europe. What exactly transpired last week?
Well, it would appear on Tuesday evening, early hours of Wednesday morning last week, about 19 UAVs entered Polish airspace, and they released four different locations where UAVs came down after being intercepted. So there was some damage to buildings on the ground. The Russian probe, and I think that's what it was, the Russians denied that it was deliberate. But most military analysts believe that's essentially a pretty thin denial. It was almost certainly deliberate. It was a probing operation launched by the Kremlin to test the reactions and the political will of Poland, as well as its NATO partners. And the other thing here, Alex, is that Poland isn't the only country which has been the subject to Russian drone incursions. Lithuania experienced one in August, and over the weekend, Romania also experienced a 50-minute Russian drone incursion. It was just a solitary drone. But nevertheless, these are provocative incursions in the airspace of countries which are members of NATO.
And why are these incursions such violations of the airspace? Why are they such a message and a provocation?
Well, I think in a sense, Mr. Putin is showing that he has no peace plans in Ukraine anytime soon. The biggest stumbling block has been Putin's refusal to accept an immediate ceasefire. And the Ukrainians made it clear they would accept an immediate ceasefire. It's quite clear that Mr. Putin wants to retain all the fruits of his invasion, his illegal invasion of Ukraine. Russia occupies about 20%. And his terms for peace are essentially those of surrender by Ukraine. The Trump administration has been incredibly weak in relation to the Putin government. It keeps threatening to take sanctions, but it always finds a way of taking a backward step after issuing a threat. And indeed, Mr. Trump's idea of a peace deal was for Mr. Putin to get much of the territory that he's wholly or partially annexed in Ukraine. So I think these drone attacks that we've seen, or these drone incursions, are indicating that Mr. Putin is not going to agree to any peace on any other terms in Ukraine other than his own. And I think it's also a humiliation for the Trump administration. I think Mr. Putin is indicating that he's not going to take too much notice of Mr. Trump's diplomatic initiatives unless they totally back Russia. And I think there's another wider message here, that until Europe realizes that they have to effectively put so much pressure on Putin that he decides to either withdraw his troops from Ukraine or is actually militarily defeated, then there's not going to be peace in Ukraine. It highlights once again that appeasement towards Russia only emboldens a Putin regime that is responsible for the invasion of Ukraine. And what's more, a possible bonus here is an attempt to split the United States from their Western European NATO members. That's always been a long-term goal of Russia.
With all that said, are we likely to continue to see events just like this in the near future?
Well, it depends on Mr. Putin, doesn't it? He caused this conflict. He could end it. He's in breach of international law. In fact, he's driven a coach and horses through the UN Charter. But I think what is beginning to happen, Alex, is that I think Europeans are realizing belatedly they cannot rely on the Trump administration in the way that Europeans previously relied on the Biden administration in dealing with the Putin threat. And the Europeans are taking serious steps to increase their defense capabilities. Remember, Mr. Putin, with his authoritarian regime, always wants to present himself as very strong and able to protect Russia. But that is beginning to break down. And Russians, particularly in big cities like St. Petersburg and Moscow, are beginning to feel the effects of this war in a way they haven't done before.
How can we expect Europe, and in particular those leading countries in NATO and Poland, to kind of react to this going forward?
Very difficult to get a united view within NATO because two countries, Hungary and Slovakia, are pro-Putin and receive oil from Russia. And they're unlikely to do anything to undermine Russia. But the rest, Germany in particular, is increasing its defence spending to 5%. Britain and France, the majority of NATO countries, if they have the political will, and it's, you might say it's belated, but it appears to be very real now, in backing Ukraine, then that'll be more than enough to offset Russia's attempt to annex Ukraine. Let's be quite clear about this. China is the biggest backer of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. If Mr. Putin fails, if he's not successful in subduing or trying to annex Ukraine, he will not politically survive, and that will be a major defeat for China, particularly because China has security interests in our part of the world. So New Zealand is one of the countries that has a big stake in Mr. Putin's attempt to develop the principle that might is right through illegally invading a country. We have a big stake as a country which takes international law seriously in seeing the Putin regime fail. But there is signs, to answer your question, that the Europeans are belatedly realizing if they don't stop, if Mr. Putin is not defeated, they could be fighting a much wider war. And these drone incursions bring that point home, that if Mr. Putin is not defeated in Ukraine, they could be fighting Mr. Putin not in just in Ukraine, but in other countries.
That was the University of Otago's Robert Patman on recent Russian drone incursions in Poland.
That's probably slightly off topic. What was the question again?
The Wire. We'll be right back. Up next, we have Gravy Train by Shoeless.
How did you
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM.
Oh yeah, let's rock and roll, man.
The Wire. In recent months, there has been a growing exodus of artists and bands moving away from Spotify. These decisions are being made along political and ethical lines as the platform continues to come under fire for a range of business practices and investments. In the streaming era, however, artists cannot make this decision lightly. Musicians often depend on streaming services like Spotify for a consistent source of income or visibility. I spoke to the University of Otago's Michael Holland about why these artists are leaving Spotify and what it means for artists to leave streaming services. For starters, why are we seeing artists leaving Spotify?
It's an interesting question at this moment because I think there's more than just the ethics question at play. So, yes, obviously, the news that, you know, Daniel Ek's investment firm of $1 billion in an AI weapons company has been sort of the straw that broke the camel's back for a lot of artists. And it's, you know, brought out some sort of ongoing frustration or sort of exacerbated some ongoing frustration about their involvement with the platform anyway. So firstly, I think it's interesting to note, you know, musicians taking a strong ethical stand. There were New Zealand artists who took a similar stand over things like performing at the South by Southwest Music Festival a few years ago due to similar issues around that organisation's funding, again involved in weapons manufacture. So it's really interesting to see that sort of ethics thing at play. But I think the other two things that are going on here have to do with the revenue that artists are able to generate or not able to generate through music streaming, and also sort of some ongoing concerns around the sort of, I guess, the dilution of the sort of, yeah, it's what an Australian academic calls the blandification of the music experience on streaming platforms, which has to do with things like stock music and sort of AI music taking an increasing share of listenership on the platform.
Spotify has long kind of seen criticism over their revenue sharing practices and various other business practices when it comes to interacting with artists. You referred to this Daniel Ek's investment as the straw that broke the camel's back, but is this something that we've been seeing bubbling for a while?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Going back as early as, you know, 2014, you had very high profile artists like Taylor Swift pulling her music from the platform. And it's sort of, it's interesting to think about, you know, as other scholars have pointed out, when we talk about revenue from streaming, we generally talk about it in how much does a musician earn per stream. And, you know, the sort of the back of the envelope figures at the moment, it's very hard to work this out, but Spotify seems to be paying about half of 1 cent per stream. And very smart people have pointed out, well, what exactly is one stream and what does that mean? And also, in what ways is that revenue allocated? Because to say that this is a question of how much Spotify pays an artist per stream sort of ignores the fact that that's not actually how they distribute revenue. So unless you're at a sort of 1,000 monthly listeners or above, as of last year, Spotify's not paying you anything. And then they're paying royalty revenue based on market share, so it's sort of a pro rata system. And in fact, David Hesmanhall, music industry scholar, has pointed out that the revenue that independent artists in particular are able to generate would improve a lot if Spotify did, in fact, pay artists per stream, which, I mean, they could do. The revenue distribution is, on the one hand, transparent, but also it's not geared in the favour of independent artists. Spotify, you know, celebrated last year that they had distributed $10 billion US in royalties, but less than 5% of musicians were generating over sort of about $130,000 a year. So, yeah, they are bringing in income from subscription and generating those royalties, distributing them back to artists. But for lots of independent artists, I think there's some very good reasons why they might look at this and say, deck stacked against me here. I'm actually not sure that there's much of a path to certainly for a lot of independent artists, I don't think streaming revenues can be their sole source of income and music.
And a lot of these artists that we've seen pull off the platform have also highlighted Spotify's use of AI on the platform. How are these AI algorithms and also AI artists kind of influencing this bad environment for artists?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tricky question. One of the things that is worth mentioning here is Liz Pally's work on Spotify's Perfect Fit content program. So a lot of what you encounter when you stream that Cafe Jazz playlist is not, in fact, the work of jazz musicians trying to build a career and a sort of artist identity. It is, in fact, the work of us paid to create stock music. And we have Australia at the moment looking at the way that the AI algorithms that are determining playlists, and especially personalised playlists, that they start to contribute to this experience of kind of blandification of everything sort of starting to sound the same and sort of pushing music into the background. And I think, I work with young music producers who are very passionate about their work. And, you know, we idealise our engagement with music, whether it's as audiences or as people who create it. We think of it as like, yeah, I'm passionate about music. And I pay attention to it. You know, I really engage with music in a certain way. But actually, increasingly, streaming is contributing to music as sort of background noise. So I can see a number of artists being quite unhappy about that.
With that said, these moves off of the platform from artists, what does this actually mean for their livelihoods and their possibilities of success?
Again, it varies. So to talk about a Kiwi example that's sort of unfolding at the moment, you know, Tiki Tane is very publicly removing his work from Spotify. And for someone like him, that will have implications for, appreciable implications for the revenue he's generating. You know, I think he's got 150,000 monthly listeners. So that means that he will be, you know, losing an appreciable amount of money. Whereas for other artists, for independent artists, it may not be a question of taking a huge hit in terms of income because it is so hard to generate significant revenue on streaming services. The issue is, though, that things like having your work in prominent playlists, things like your streaming metrics, are all sort of barometers that are used by various other parties in the music industry. For example, you know, lots of our young musicians here apply for New Zealand Music Funding to make the first recording. And one of the criteria for that funding is, you know, how many streams do you have, or do you have X number of streams for your work? Certainly, you know, like music festivals, promoters, people like that will look to this as one of many kind of metrics that they might use to assess an artist's sort of popularity and viability and all those things. But I would sort of suggest that what this might mean long term for especially indie musicians is a good look at what it means to have audience engagement. And so, yes, having a lot of people streaming your work could mean that you have a really engaged audience, but actually, perhaps this is a call to think about, you know, the quality of that engagement. Exactly how many of those people who are streaming your work in the background are those audience members who are going to do all those things that are going to help you to have a meaningful and sustainable relationship with your fan base.
That was the University of Otago's Michael Holland about why artists are leaving Spotify and what that means for artists.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
Ko ira te ho taka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou I korero mai ki maua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Monday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today, the ACT Party's Simon Court, Aotearoa for Palestine's Nadine Mortaja, and participants at the March for Humanity rally, and the University of Otago's Emma Anderson, Robert Patman, and Michael Holland. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakaronga ana. Thank you for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Penny. We'll be right back.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.